Welcome back to Brainwaves, the Neurocom podcast hosted by yours truly, Garrett Kerteff.
And Monsi Desai. We're two PhD students at UT Austin and best friends who love to nerd out about the brain, language, and music.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about how we got here.
Ourselves, you mean?
Yeah, we're going to talk about ourselves, you know, like the primordial soup that we crawled out of to be in this podcasting room recording our first episode.
It's pretty exciting.
All right, Monsi. So the reason I wanted to do this for the first episode is because I feel like we both have kind of unique backgrounds that don't necessarily explain why we're here.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I mean, they explain why we're here. It just takes a little bit of explaining first. It's not like, oh, I'm a neuroscientist. I study the brain.
Yeah, it's definitely not intuitive by any means, or at least our journeys here are not that intuitive.
Yeah. Okay, so... When do you think that your brain voyage started?
Honestly, I think that my brain voyage, as you just said, started, must have been when I was really young, like maybe 10 or 11. So I guess just for background, I'm actually a trained classical pianist, and I've been playing the piano since I was 5. I also play the tabla, which are Indian classical drums, and I started playing the tabla around the same time as well. But I think what got me into, you know, music and the brain and just generally neuroscience was actually around this one particular instance when I was volunteering at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. And at the time, my piano teacher, as a part of her studio, had these sort of volunteering hours in which we would go perform for, you know, patients who are a part of this hospital. And I think I really saw how music affected people and sort of made them come to life when they're really in this comatose state. And it really kind of piqued my interest in terms of doing a lot of brain-related stuff. And my large overlying question, which is obviously not the most scientifically sound at the time, was, well, how does music really affect the brain?
So you're like a walking copy of Oliver Sacks's musicophilia.
Wouldn't say to that extent, but I will say that his books and reading a lot of his stories kind of inspired me to go down this rabbit hole of music and neuroscience and now kind of speech.
Did you know he was really into motorcycles?
That's a really strange fact.
He's kind of a badass.
Oh, that's cool. I honestly wouldn't put it past him. That guy was pretty awesome.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace.
Okay, so you're like 10 or 11 years old, you're volunteering at this hospital, and something clicks in your tiny brain, and you're like, wow, music can affect the brain, the thing that I
go figure, the thing that makes me allows me to play music.
Yeah, so you had this realization, and where did you run from there? Like, what was your first step?
Well, honestly, my first step was I need to go to college. And
that's important.
Yeah, just slightly. And I didn't really know anything else better to do than to continue music. I went to this really small arts high school called School of the Arts. I was born and raised in San Francisco.
It's a descriptive name for a high school.
I know. Now it's called Ruth Asawa School of the Arts because apparently I think she donated a lot of money or something like that. I don't know. Don't quote me on it.
That's how you get your name on a high school.
That's really how you get your name on most things in life is just money with wings, like money that flies. Whatevs.
So you went to college and you studied music. Were you still thinking about brains at this point, or was it just like, I'm going to play music?
I actually entered as a double major in piano performance as like a bachelor's of music student, as well as a degree in biopsychology.
Okay.
And that was probably one of the hardest things that I had to do. And it eventually kind of made me realize that I didn't want to do both, and I couldn't justify doing both in such a short amount of time. So I kind of eventually dropped the biopsych idea, was sort of like, maybe I should do pre-med just so I can take all the science classes.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. it's I feel like most people have probably been there, and then they realize that med school is really not for them. And I realized very quickly that med school is not for me.
I'm just not intelligent enough for med school. Anyways, you are a music major.
I was a music major.
Somehow.
And I think that my first research opportunity really came about during my junior and into my senior year. And I worked through the psychological brain sciences department. I studied or worked under Dr. Rebecca Schaefer. She's back in the Netherlands now, and she's an assistant professor. And we were interested in examining how metaphors affect performance practice in professional musicians, specifically pianists. And we were trying to measure what parts of the brain light up based on certain metaphors in an fMRI.
Okay, cool. So this is an imaging study, some magnetic resonance.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about different ways of recording brain activity in some of the future episodes, but just a sneak preview of some of the stuff that we'll talk about and what I was doing.
Coming soon to our one loyal listener.
Yes.
Liberty Hamilton.
Liberty Hamilton.
Shout out to Liberty Hamilton.
She will be on our next episode. I'm so excited.
So you have classical pianists in a scanner, and then from there, you find yourself at UCSF, right? Or am I missing a step in the middle there?
More or less. Well, I ended up getting a connection at UCSF through Rebecca because she knew a person who knew someone else, and they were looking for interns for a summer project. And I was like, I should just apply, see what happens. And so I did, and I ended up having an internship at UCSF for 3 months. And that ended up actually leading into a full-time position, which is where I met you.
Yeah, that is where you met me, huh?
Yeah, and now we've had our journey there, and now we're kind of having our journey at UT. But before we get into our journey at UT, why don't we talk a little bit about you, Garrett?
Yeah, why don't we? I mean, I put myself on this podcast and everything. Cool. So where do you want to start?
So kind of where do you come from, and what did you do in your undergrad that led you here to your grad program now?
Yeah, so I was born in Monterey, California. I've sort of been like orbiting the Bay Area my whole life. Spent some time in Stockton and Berkeley. I didn't get to live in San Francisco proper until after I'd graduated college. But I guess the brain was more of an afterthought for me than it was for you. It wasn't like I was 10 years old and I had this like epiphany where I was like, wow, you can do so much with the brain. What I really came into this field from was the behavioral side of things. So I, growing up, had a lot of friends that were kind of like awkward or maybe had some mental health problems. One of my best friends in high school had autism spectrum disorder. And I sort of thought to myself, well, can I make a career out of helping people like this? I've always thought of myself as a helper. I'm very empathetic. And that led me to med school. Oh God, how did I get there?
Oh, but you didn't actually do med school.
I did for one semester. I was pre-med. And then I got a D in chemistry.
Yeah. Ooh, yikes. We've also been there. We've all been there.
We've all gotten D's in chemistry.
Yeah, more or less.
Sweet. Yeah, so I started Berkeley as pre-med because I was like, I want to help these people because people are cool. But soon realized I was misguided and that med school was not the best way to accomplish that. So I switched to psychology, also sort of misguidedly because I'm not a psychologist anymore. But yeah, I thought I could be a counselor. So I'm going to study psychology. And I don't know. I have close friends that are psychologists. I feel like I give psychology a bad rap sometimes. But I also don't really think it was for me. And I didn't really find what I loved to do until a couple of years had gone by at UC Berkeley, and I had to take a linguistics course for my psych major. And the professor of that course was Keith Johnson, who you're smiling at me.
I am smiling at you because I also know Keith Johnson from our time at UCSF, but we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of foreshadowing for you there. Keith Johnson, on the first day of class, described himself as the leading phonetician of his generation.
You're like, how pretentious.
Yeah, I thought this guy was kind of a dick. Turns out he was right. He is the leading phonetician of his generation.
The guy's pretty brilliant.
I've bought multiple of his textbooks at this point in time. Yeah, but he was teaching an interlinguistics course for non-linguistics majors, because at the time I was a psych student, and seeing him, this like brilliant linguist, in such an elementary setting was a thrill. He was doing what we call PowerPoint karaoke, just reading off of these slides that he didn't even make himself. It was a big publishing company had like created an interlinguistics textbook that came with slides. So he assigned us that textbook. All the quizzes were written by the publishing company, and he just read off of these slides. I feel like he did nothing, except every Friday he would just completely go off the deep end into some topic in linguistics, like completely over the heads of everybody in the classroom.
We just go on and on.
Yeah, pure, unrefined rambling. We did a lot of Wikipedia editing in that class.
And he would say, you know, based off of students from UC Berkeley, they state blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I've told you this story before, haven't I?
Yes, we've talked about this a lot.
Yeah, he, instead of citing references, he would just say, according to students in the interlinguistics course at UC Berkeley, hopefully those pages have been edited by now.
You should probably see if they still exist, for fun.
I've never checked in on them. Well, anyway, this sort of like weird course with this eccentric professor really made me fall in love with linguistics. And I spent like the next 2 years of my life just obsessed with languages. I took a lot of foreign language courses. I took a lot of linguistics courses. I got into conlanging, which is creating your own constructed languages from scratch. Shout outs to David J. Peterson, creator of Dothraki for Game of Thrones. He's a homie. Taught me a lot about the craft. And then I was about to graduate and I realized, wait, how do linguists make money? It's hard to do that. It's hard to make money as a linguist. So I remembered, oh yeah, that's like the whole reason I started going into this higher education stuff is because I wanted to help people. How do you combine language and helping people? You work at a record store, which is what I did after I graduated. But fortunately enough, Keith Johnson, my interlinguistics professor, reached out to me after I had been working at Rasputin Records in Berkeley for a while. And he said, hey, I know this guy at UCSF. He is in the neurosurgery department. He works with language impairment and recovery from aphasia and all of this other cool sort of neuroscience of language and speech stuff. He's looking for a linguist.
And that's how we met.
Yeah, so that planted us both at UCSF. But we were physically and mentally distant at UCSF. Physically, I had the corner desk, so I was always hiding out around the corner.
We would never know if Garrett was actually at work or not, and we'd all just have to get up and go around the corner and be like, is Garrett there? Is Garrett sleeping? Is Garrett doing work?
I may have done some of those things. At some times.
Eddie, if you're listening, we apologize.
That was a joke, Eddie, if you're listening. I always worked exactly 8 hours every day I was in your lab. Anyways, and then sort of mentally, we were doing different projects. You wanna talk about what you were doing at UCSF?
Yeah, so what I did at UCSF was basically nothing of what I'm doing here at UT Austin with Liberty Hamilton in her lab. And a lot of my work there and sort of what I was helping out with was all about neuropsychiatric disorders. So we worked a lot with patients who had depression and anxiety, but not really specifically those patients, but patients who came in for epilepsy monitoring.
Yeah, so for listeners that might not know what intractable epilepsy means, it is a condition. It's a subset of epilepsy, which is a disorder that is characterized by chronic seizures. seizure is basically an electrical storm in the brain, just a lot of neurons sort of firing randomly. When people traditionally picture seizures, they think of like convulsing as a grand mal seizure, but there are lots of kinds of seizures. For example, a lot of the patients that we worked with at UCSF would have temporal lobe seizures, where their seizures would manifest as a sort of lapse in comprehension. People just sort of like space out for a second while they're having a seizure and there's no visible motor effects. So you have seizures, you have epilepsy. The way to treat that is with medicine. But for some people, the medicine isn't enough. And this is what we call intractable epilepsy.
Right. And so then these patients come in to UCSF and they go through a surgical procedure where they get electrodes temporarily placed onto the surface of their brain, or they put electrodes kind of deeper into the brain if they think that their seizure is coming from these inner structures.
Trying to measure the thunderstorm a little bit.
Right. And they're trying to localize the thunderstorm as well. And the whole point of this is to see if doctors can actually remove parts of the brain tissue that's responsible for these seizures so that the patient doesn't have these seizures anymore. And that's sort of the process of this is, you know, can be pretty long. It can be kind of short. It just sort of depends on how many seizures a patient has during their time in the hospital. But when they're in the hospital, we actually have, as researchers, have gone into their room and kind of asked if they wanted to participate in a variety of tasks.
For those of you that haven't been in a hospital bed before, it's pretty boring. For these patients with intractable epilepsy, they are just sitting around waiting to have a seizure a lot of the time, because you can't have the procedure to get the tissue that's causing your epilepsy removed until you have a seizure. And the epileptologists look at it and they determine, oh, that's where it's coming from. Let's cut this out. So literally, you're just sitting around. And we researchers come in the meantime and we say, hey, do you want to do some tasks for us? We'll even compensate you.
Right. So that's sort of a lot of what I did was I helped out with running tasks in the hospital room, and a lot of these tasks did involve, you know, asking questions about their mood. Sometimes we would look at their past neuropsychiatric evaluations and see what their depression and anxiety levels were like. And so that's, yeah, in terms of what I did at UCSF, the part of the lab that I was working in under Dr. Chang was funded by the Department of Defense, and they were essentially interested in understanding the individual biomarkers and pathways of the brain that are responsible for anxiety, depression, and eventually also we ended up having a trial to examine chronic neuropathic pain in three different types of chronic pain patients. And we were also trying to look at this existing device, which was actually a deep brain stimulator. And for those of you who do not know what a deep brain stimulator is,
please.
It is essentially a pacemaker. And there's a battery pack device that is connected to a bunch of wires and then electrodes. And these electrodes are placed inside or on the surface of the brain.
So brain pacemaker.
It is essentially a brain pacemaker. And you can optimize the parameters of this brain pacemaker, deep brain stimulator, and deliver stimulation. And the thought is that the stimulation can help alleviate symptoms of pain. And so we were trying to understand, well, how does this device really do this? How does external stimulations suppress neurons from probably overfiring in certain parts of the brain?
And how can we make it work better
for the
patients?
And how can we predict when and where these elevated pain states are coming from? And this is a really novel way of trying to understand pain, because this country has a huge opioid crisis. And so if we can find a way to try and bypass all these medications, and target the brain structure itself, then maybe we might be going somewhere with trying to figure out how to help people in this realm. So that's like a really long tangent of sort of, or just a long description of what I did at UCSF. And you're probably wondering, well, Monsi, how are you here at UT Austin right now doing music and language and brain stuff?
Wait, first a yes or no question. Would you consider yourself a master of pain?
No. That is a hard no.
I think you should call yourself that.
The master of pain.
All right. So here you are at UCSF. You're doing work with epilepsy patients that have these surgically implanted electrodes. You're doing work with deep brain stimulators. You're studying the effects of brain stimulation on emotion, on pain, on things like that. And now you're at UT Austin.
Right. And kind of the way that I got here was I, going back to UCSF, did publish a paper in which we were looking at music and language in the brain operating room.
I remember you saying you were interested in music earlier.
Right. And I worked with a former colleague, Matthew Leonard. We'll probably have him on the show. And we were trying to see what the, you know, similar pathways or dissociable pathways of the brain were in being able to play the piano or play an instrument and be able to talk. I think I'll talk a little bit more about that paper in a later episode because I thought the results were quite interesting. But because of the results and because of what we found in that paper, I got really, really interested in trying to figure out more ways and pose more questions of, you know, music and neuroscience and how the two are related or how they're not related in the brain, which is how I ended up writing my personal statement and trying to gear my research now at UT towards that. But Garrett, let's go back to you. What did you do at UCSF? Because your experience was really, really interesting. And you did something that was very different than what I did.
Oh, you mean besides napping in a corner?
Besides napping in the corner.
Oh, yeah. The other stuff was okay, I guess. So we were just going on about how all of the research in Dr. Edward Chang's lab that we were doing at UCSF was in these patients with intractable epilepsy. That's actually only half of the story. So we have these patients with these surgically implanted electrodes or grids that we call them. But then also Eddie is a neurosurgeon by trade. So in addition to being a researcher and a professor of neurosurgery, he operates on the weekly. And the kind of surgery that he did was tumor resection, in addition to the epilepsy surgery. So he has this huge patient population of people with brain tumors. These are usually caused by brain cancer or by some other sort of metastatic cancer that has sort of popped up in the brain. It's actually really sad. So these patients that are having brain surgery, they sort of thing that connects them all together is that all of these patients have their tumor in a part of the brain that is important for language. And obviously the brain is a complicated soup of neurons and you don't want to cut out something that is important when you are doing the surgery. So the way that Dr. Chang and many other neurosurgeons have accomplished this is through brain mapping or electrocortical stimulation or cortical stimulation mapping. There's like 1,000 names for it. But essentially, what we're doing is we are applying electrical current to the brain during surgery. And what this does is it simulates a small little lesion in that area. So by applying current to the brain, we can ask the question, well, what would this person look like or how would they act if this part of their brain didn't function? So it's sort of like we can pretend like it's been removed for a little bit. So it's like, okay, if we cut this out, what's going to happen is the idea.
So how do you go about doing that? Well, also, do you do this?
No, I do not do this. Like I said, D in chemistry, never went to med school. So that's actually a great question. What am I, a pitiful little linguist, doing?
In the operating room.
In the operating room. Yes, I was actually in the operating room for dozens of these mapping cases. I am talking to the patient who is awake during the surgery. So they've had part of their skull removed. They've had the cortex, which is the sort of top layer of the brain, exposed. And that's what we're going to be stimulating to see what is important so that we can avoid cutting it out during the surgery. And I am giving them sort of language tests, pointing to my watch and saying, what's this? Or pulling a pen out of my pocket and saying, what's this? Maybe showing them some pictures, having them count to 30. Maybe they give me a thumbs up and we see if we can make their finger move with stimulation. Yeah, so I'm giving them all of these tests and we are seeing what we can disrupt when we stimulate the brain. And if we can disrupt any of these tasks, let's say they can't name the thing I'm asking them to name, they can't count while we're stimulating. In your case, they can't play an instrument while we're stimulating.
Right.
The surgeon marks that part of the brain and they mark it using what is essentially a sterile sticky note. It's like a little number or a letter and it says, hey, don't cut this out, please. It's important. And that is the first sort of pin on our brain map. And we do this. It usually lasts anywhere between 20 minutes to like 45 minutes. We don't have a whole lot of time because this is during brain surgery. We want to work as quickly as possible. But we try to generate a brain map. So it's a bunch of little tags on the brain, and these tell us where the important functions are. And then once the surgeon has that map, he or she can plan the surgery from there. How do you get to the tumor or the epileptogenic tissue or the thing you're trying to cut out of the brain while disrupting as few of these sort of map points as possible?
Right. And all these map points are very different based on each individual who comes in for surgery. And so I think clinical mapping or clinical language mapping is really important so that we get the right part of the brain that you need to cut out.
Yeah, very clinically important because we want people to be able to talk after surgery. You know, communication's really important.
Or move or play their instrument or have basic normal, relatively normal function.
Absolutely. So that's why we do the mapping. But mapping is also really interesting as a researcher because we are showing what parts of the brain are responsible for different things. You know, if we stimulate somewhere and they stop counting, we can say very naively, oh, that part of the brain might be important for counting. It's not that simple, obviously, but that's the gist of it. I wrote a couple of papers while I was at UCSF on this method, on electrocortical stimulation. And in the context of language, mostly because that's what we were mapping in these surgeries. And that sort of was the connection for me. That was, oh, this is how I do something cool with language. I can use language to help people. And that's sort of combining my passion, which is language, with what I wanted to do, which was help people in a clinical setting. And that was sort of like my Reese's peanut butter cup, you know. It was like, all right, I get to have the best of both worlds.
And so that then in turn allowed you to and helped you apply for grad school, and now you're here. So what are you doing here, and how does that sort of connect to what you were doing at UCSF?
Well, here I'm in Dr. Liberty Hamilton's lab with another podcaster in this room. and I am very loosely studying speech production. And the reason I'm studying speech production is because I think it is a little understudied in the field right now. It's harder to get at. When you speak, when you move your mouth, it creates a lot of blurry images if you're trying to take pictures of the brain in an fMRI scanner, or if you're trying to record from electrodes like on an EEG. So it's a little tricky, but I think it's rewarding. And how it ties into what I did at UCSF is all of the things that I was studying at UCSF using this brain stimulation data was production, because we were trying to disrupt what the patient was saying. And this is in contrast, of course, to perception research, which is sort of the meat and potatoes of auditory neuroscience, studying how the brain interprets sound, how it interprets language, things like that. So that's sort of the research aspect of what I'm doing here at UT. And then I'm also in a master's program right now in training to be a speech language pathologist. And the reason I want to do that is because of all of my experience working with aphasia at UCSF.
Aphasia. Oh, you didn't talk about aphasia.
I didn't even talk about aphasia.
Do you want to give a couple sentences about
I do. I
what
love aphasia.
Aphasia is?
Yeah, I had an aphasia bumper sticker on my car for a while. That's how crazy I am about it. So aphasia is a very common disorder that nobody really knows the definition of. If you ask a layperson, they did a survey. It was like 1% of like average people like understand what this is. So I'll provide a definition. Aphasia is a neurogenic impairment of your ability to communicate or understand language. So you have something happen to your brain and you lose some or all of your ability to understand what people are saying or to say things yourselves. And all aphasia is hallmarked by word finding difficulty. Have you ever wanted to say something and you know what it is and it's like on the tip of your tongue and you're like, oh, what is it? I know it. It's not this. It's come on. That is what having aphasia is like, but all the time. As you can imagine, it's quite frustrating. And I'm sure we'll talk about the sort of emotional and social.
And there's a lot of different things that can cause aphasia.
That's true. And one such thing that can cause aphasia, specifically caused most of the aphasia I worked with at UCSF, is having brain surgery. And when you have part of your brain removed, the rest of your brain sort of swells up and creates what is known as edema, which is like a buildup of fluid or swelling in the brain. And this can sort of scramble things for a little bit while the brain recovers from the trauma of having surgery. And while things are scrambled, a lot of people experience aphasia. And I would go in and I would do assessments with these patients and then compare how they were doing after their surgery to how they were doing before their surgery when I recorded my baseline. And the sort of interesting thing about these neurosurgical patients, in contrast to, say, stroke survivors, which is the majority population for people with aphasia, is that people who have had brain surgery tend to recover quite well from aphasia because when the swelling, when the edema goes down, so does the aphasia. This isn't necessarily true of stroke survivors, although prognosis does improve over time. It's a much slower recovery window. And the window of recovery that I was sort of operating within at UCSF was the scale of a month. You would get people that would be completely unable to talk. They wouldn't remember their daughter's names 2 days after their surgery. And then a month later, you wouldn't even have known that they had brain surgery a month ago.
Yeah. And we have some really awesome researchers in this department who do aphasia research. And there's all different kinds of types of aphasia. And so we'll probably get one of those experts on a future.
Shout out to Maya Henry.
Yeah. So we'll probably hopefully get one of those guys onto the podcast in a future episode.
Yeah. So working with aphasia made me want to be a speech language pathologist. And I eventually want to combine my research on speech production and the neuroscience of such into some sort of clinical setting, into what I like doing, which is helping people. Still sussing it out. But, you know, I've only been here for a year.
Yeah. It's a process.
It's a process. Great. So that sort of lands us both squarely at UT Austin. I don't think you've actually talked about your research here yet. So
no.
Do you want to just say what you're doing?
So while you're interested in trying to understand what allows us to talk, I'm interested in figuring out kind of how sound travels into the ear and gets processed into the brain. And so one of the...
Perception.
Right? Speech, yeah. Perception. And yeah, perception of sounds, I guess. I wouldn't say that I'm just limiting my work to speech only, but speech is a huge component of it.
So there's a difference between just like regular old sound and speech, huh?
There are a lot of interesting studies out there and some more recently actually showing that there may be different circuitry in the brain depending on what kind of sound you're actually interested in. It's weird. And I don't 100% quote me on all of that. I'm still trying to delve into this literature a bit, but this is just talk on the street at the moment.
I don't know if you can sense the sarcasm at home, dear listeners, but yeah, there's a little bit of difference based on what sort of sound you're listening to. The brain in particular really cares about language, but it also cares about sounds, and that's sort of where you jump in.
Yeah, and the biggest question being, well, okay, if maybe a lot of you have not heard about this phenomena called the cocktail party effect. And the cocktail party effect is the ability to hear someone call your name in a really busy, crowded environment, such as if you're at a cocktail party, and you can automatically shift your attention and attend to that. And so that exists.
Have you ever just like been in a crowded room and someone is like, "Hey, Monty," and then all of a sudden you just like shoot towards them and you're like, "What do you want from me?"
Yeah. Or sometimes you hear a sound that sounds like your name, but it's not.
Oh, like me at Starbucks. Do you know how many names I get at Starbucks? I get
Garrett. Well,
sometimes
Derek.
I get Garrett. Derrett, Jared, Eric, Aaron. I've gotten Barrett before. I didn't even know that was a name.
Interesting. Yeah, but your attention will shift, right? So how is your brain able to do that? And then from a clinical standpoint, I'm not training to be a speech and language pathologist, but I do have clinical research interest. So from a clinical setting, people who are hard of hearing or they've suffered through some sort of hearing loss have issues picking up on speech and noise. And there's a lot of anatomical, physiological reasons as to why that is. And a lot of people study that just kind of from the ear itself, like the inner ear, and then part of the brainstem. But we don't really know a whole lot of what's going on in the brain or, you know, in the cortex.
Higher up,
like what we call higher order processing.
Yeah, I was actually talking to my grandma about this a couple of weeks ago. She's a hearing aid user, and she says that she just hates being in restaurants because the noise really affects her ability to hear.
Yeah, it's definitely a common complaint amongst most hearing aid users. That's also the same for people who have had cochlear implants. So when they've gone through a surgery to put, you know, get electrodes to stimulate parts of their cochlea so they can hear again, but it doesn't do a very good job of picking up the external sounds or sounds in the background, and it just sounds like noise, and that's really irritating. And so is it possible?
You're trying to solve this issue with the brain.
Right. So can we look beyond the ear and beyond the brainstem and look more into maybe an attention-related aspect of the brain in terms of hearing and sort of what is the connection between the two that allows us to attend to what we want to hear as healthy listeners? We have normal hearing. I think I have normal hearing. Hopefully you do too. But you know, what allows us to do that, and how is the circuitry different, or how is it affected for other people who have hearing impairments? And so I'm interested in understanding, well, what parts of the brains are responsible for various aspects of speech, and how is that different for other non-speech sounds, like maybe music does occupy a different part of the brain, or other background noises. So that's sort of the larger overarching question that I have.
Sweet. Are you doing anything with music in particular? Because I'm just thinking about you as the classically trained pianist. I'm sure you don't want to give up that part of your identity when you're doing your PhD.
I have a few ideas in mind, but I'm going to leave the suspense rising for the time being.
A little cliffhanger, huh?
A little cliffhanger.
Okay, well,
I have a few ideas. Thought a little bit about it.
A little bit about music?
Just a little bit.
Okay, I haven't thought about it at all.
Okay, good to know.
All right, Monty, do you think that we solved the brain?
You know, I think we solved the brain. As always, thanks to Rioso for our intro and outro music. Check out all his tunes in the link below. Thanks to UT Austin's Moody College of Communication for letting us use their facilities. See you next time.